Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. President-elect Donald Trump has signaled a drastic shift in the nation's approach to energy and climate concerns. Trump says he will deregulate the energy industry, eliminating environmental protections put in place by President Obama. And he's named leaders to his cabinet who are both climate change skeptics and champions of the oil industry. Some climate scientists worry Donald Trump will put the world on an irreversible path toward extreme and dangerous global warming, causing rising sea levels, extreme droughts and food shortages, and more powerful floods and storms. But what can and can't President-elect Donald Trump do? This hour, we're going to look at Trump's cabinet appointments and campaign promises in regards to energy and the environment, and just what powers he has as president to follow through on those promises. I'm joined by Meg Jacobs, Princeton historian and author of Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Meg, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by via Skype by Katie Fehrenbacher. She's an energy and technology journalist. Katie, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, too.
We'd also love to hear from you. What do you think of President-elect Trump's stance on energy and the environment? What are your hopes and or concerns? Give us a call with your question or comment, 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. You can also reach us online at nprnews.org/live. Here's Donald Trump on the campaign trail.
America is sitting on a treasure trove of untapped energy. Some $50 trillion in shale energy, oil reserves, and natural gas on federal lands, in addition to hundreds of years of coal energy reserves. It's all upside for this country. More jobs, more revenues, more wealth, higher wages, and lower energy prices. I'm going to lift the restrictions on American energy.
Katie Fehrenbacher, is what Donald Trump says there true, that we're sitting on these massive reserves of oil and coal?
We are sitting on large reserves of oil. I guess the coal industry has been going for a while, but the coal industry is somewhat in a decline, and that's partly because of market restrictions. Market economics. The cost of clean energy has become so cheap that and natural gas has risen, so that the cost of coal has started to rise. But it's true that there are large reserves of oil. I mean, the problem is that releasing the oil releases carbon emissions. So there's a big problem, you know, obviously with climate change.
Mm-hmm. And Meg Jacobs, what do you think? Is Donald Trump able to follow through on this kind of a promise? Can he do what he's saying he'll do?
He has a lot of power. He has a lot of power through his appointments, which we have seen have been much more friendly, incredibly friendly towards the oil industry's interests. And he has power also through executive action. So he has a lot of tools at his disposal to reverse a lot of the kinds of things that President Obama did with those same kinds of powers.
Let's talk a little bit about the appointments he's made in recent weeks leading up to his inauguration in January. He has named former Texas Governor Rick Perry to lead the U.S. Department of Energy. This is a department he both forgot about and then threatened to eliminate during a Republican presidential primary debate back in 2011. What are we to make of the appointment of Rick Perry?
Yeah, well, I think the more significant thing, you know, the forgetting about it is almost sort of wish fulfillment, because I think the more significant thing is his desire to get rid of it. And this has a history that is, if you go back to Ronald Reagan, if you the history is appointing people who are hostile to the agencies that they are tasked with running. So Ronald Reagan did the same thing through people like James Watt, through his first energy secretary, Ronald Reagan's energy secretary, James Edwards, who said he was going to work himself out of a job. So this has its own precedent. Whether they can actually eliminate agencies is unlikely, but it does reflect and reveal their disposition and what they're intending to do.
Katie Fehrenbacher, in terms of talking about Rick Perry as department in the Secretary of Department of Energy, he's also on the board of directors of Energy Transfer Partners. That's the Texas-based company that's building the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. Is that bode well for oil deregulation and getting pipelines pushed through?
I mean, one thing is clear: the big oil and the oil industry is going to have, you know, not necessarily unprecedented, but a lot of power in this new administration. I mean, at the same time, Rick Perry has also been a strong advocate of wind in Texas. Texas has the largest wind industry in the U.S. So it's not all bad with Rick Perry, but there's a lot to be concerned with.
Meg Jacobs, you mentioned that this is something similar to what President Ronald Reagan did. How did it play out for his administration, appointing these people to the departments who are not necessarily friends of the departments?
Well, I think they were quite effective, from having James Watt as the Interior Secretary and Ann Gorsuch at EPA. I mean, they were very militant about their intentions to scale back regulations, and in the cases where they could not scaled them back, simply not to enforce them. And then the complementary tactic, which I think Trump has the right personnel in place to do this kind of thing, is to defund these agencies, to cut their budgets so that they have fewer dollars and fewer personnel to do the kinds of enforcement that they're not inclined to do anyway. And that's what we saw with Ronald Reagan. That could trigger a countermobilization by congressmen sympathetic to the environment and at the grassroots. But in the first instance, I think we'll see a pretty significant policy shift.
The current energy secretary is Ernest Moniz, who's a nuclear physicist, and he helped broker the Iran nuclear deal, which Perry has vocally criticized. That's certainly a change to go from a nuclear physicist to somebody who's skeptical of science and climate science.
That's certainly true, and that's a through line through all of the appointments, sort of skepticism of climate change science. We've seen that with many of the appointments of people who will be in one way or another involved in overseeing energy regulations, and that's profound. I mean, that will have a real impact, whether it's the specifics of trying to reverse President Obama's Clean Power Plan or attempts to pull out of the Paris Accords. The sort of upfront nature of dismissing and denying the climate change science will be profound.
This hour, we're talking about President-elect Donald Trump's energy policy and his appointments, and what we can indicate from this in terms of his shift in stance on energy resources and climate concerns. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Online, you can also reach us at nprnews.org/live. Let's go to the phones. We've got Pat on the line in Minneapolis. Pat, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, this is not about Mr. Trump, but decades ago, Mingo County was the site of many, many mountains removed for energy.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's in the news for drugs, and I'm wondering about the connection.
All right. That's an interesting question. So are we talking about how the mining industry, and when we bring sort of resources and industries like oil fracking to a community, and how that affects the community surrounding it? Meg Jacobs, have you seen that in your work?
Well, I mean, I think this speaks to a larger issue. I'm not familiar with the local situation your caller is referencing, but, you know, one of the challenges is how do we move from a fossil fuel-based economy to something else? And particularly in the coal industry, you've seen the challenges of coal miners losing their jobs, of a decline in the industry, and these areas are economically vulnerable. So the question is how to sort of alleviate and address their needs while planning for a different kind of non-fossil fuel-based future.
Katie Fehrenbacher?
I think one of the things that's concerning about Trump is that he has kind of made these promises to bring coal jobs back. So I think there are a lot of these economically fragile areas where a lot of the coal jobs have gone away, and there I do not see ways that the Trump administration will bring them back. And I think that goes for a lot of this transition from fossil fuel energy to natural gas and renewables.
Mm-hmm. Now, the person President-elect Donald Trump has selected to lead the EPA, Republican Attorney General of Oklahoma Scott Pruitt, has gone after the Obama administration on almost every regulation. Now he's going to be in charge of those regulations. Does this sound similar to what you were saying before, Meg, about the Reagan administration? Do we expect to see something similar there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and here's a case where we don't really have to guess because Scott Pruitt has a track record and he became attorney general with the help and backing of Harold Hamm, whom I, you know, an oil billionaire who I imagine will play a role in advising Trump, even if informally, on energy policy. And Pruitt has a record of trying to use his power within the state of Oklahoma to scale back regulations that restrict the oil industry, and he will bring that to bear from the seat of power in Washington. And that's exactly what we saw under Ronald Reagan with people, like I mentioned before, James Watt in the Interior Department. You know, from his point of view, it was the early day equivalent of drill, baby, drill, that it would sort of be open season for the oil and gas industry.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Grayson on the line in Wakefield, Michigan. Welcome to the phone. Welcome to the show. What's your comment or question, Grayson?
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate the chance to speak up here a little bit. I'm a retired helicopter pilot and saw a lot of the devastation of the glaciers up in Alaska. So I started studying the consensus and consilience of the science organizations. And, you know, when they say 97% of the scientists, I mean, we're talking about all the national academies of science worldwide. The Royal Academy, the Pope's Pontifical Academy, the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, our mm-hmm. American Chemical Society, Physical Society, American Geophysical Union, and go on and on, right?
Right.
But they're all pretty much screaming at us now that we have to do something. I mean, I think the Union of Concerned Scientists got immediately 2,000 signatures that sent off to President-elect Trump. And in our talk, we have to realize that we as citizens have to be more vocal and join climate groups like Citizens Climate Lobby or 350.org. Or, and even how we talk, I know this is sounds like I'm kind of splitting hairs here, but if you were use the word skeptic, that gives these people some credibility as if they are actually scientists.
What would you prefer to call them instead of a climate change skeptic?
Well, I would refer you to the Associated Press International Style Book, and it was agreed after a review. They were petitioned by the Skeptic magazine and the Science News. No, I'm sorry, that's incorrect, but another skeptic magazine.
And what's the phrase that they
use the word? And they said use the word denier, which is actually a psychological term, or the word doubter.
Okay, great. Thank you for that, Grayson. Then we should point out that Oklahoma Republican Attorney General Scott Pruitt is a climate change denier. Katie Fehrenbacher, what do you make of this, of him being in charge of the EPA?
I mean, it's disturbing for people who are concerned about climate change and who are clean energy advocates. It's definitely disturbing to have someone questioning and being skeptical of the science behind climate change, like your caller said, that almost all scientists agree with the causes behind climate change that are man-made. So overall, you know, I think we don't necessarily know what's going to happen, but I think we know that Scott Pruitt is going to do everything in his power to get rid of the Clean Power Plan, which is the chief way that the U.S. is going to meet its climate change, its carbon emissions lowering commitments through the Paris Agreement. So I think that's disturbing.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about that he's made this promise to cancel, I believe he called it, the Paris Climate Agreement, in terms of this is a worldwide, you know, this is an agreement signed by more than 100 countries to reduce emissions, and the United States being one of number two in terms of how the amount of emissions, carbon emissions it puts out in the atmosphere. And for it to pull out, what does this signal to other countries? How does this affect the Paris Climate Agreement?
I mean, I'm not sure the U.S. is going to be able to officially pull out or, you know, rip up, I think is one of the terms that mm-hmm. Trump had used when he was campaigning. I don't think the U.S. will necessarily do that. But by eliminating the Clean Power Plan, the U.S. won't be able to meet its commitments. So the U.S. won't be able to fulfill what it said it was going to do. And since we are a leading nation, it sets a bad precedent and a bad tone for sure. I mean, the rest of Europe, China, I think will take a lead in place of the U.S. if the U.S. isn't able to lead itself.
But countries like India that are relying on additional funding to help them reduce their carbon emissions, this affects them, doesn't it, Meg Jacobs?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a real question and of what the exact implications will be and how much of a move beyond fossil fuels will be driven by the market versus compelled by regulation. So there's real concerns that without the proper public policies in place, that the efforts to reduce emissions won't happen in a sufficient way, that is to say that market forces alone won't shift us towards wind and solar, for example, even as those technologies have significantly come down in price. So it's a real question how we're going to fulfill our obligations and, as Katie said, what this signals to other countries who are trying to move beyond fossil fuels but feel that the United States has to play its part.
We're talking this hour about President-elect Donald Trump's stance on energy and climate change, looking at the appointments he's made in the weeks leading up to his inauguration, as well as the promises he's made on the campaign trail. If you'd like to join us with your question or comment, what do you think of his stance on energy and climate change? And what are your hopes or concerns about his administration? Give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. You can also join us online at nprnews.org/live. I'd like to go back to the phones now. Let's go to Bob in St. Paul. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. I'm worried about the brain drain that we may have in the among our civil servant scientist population. If Trump is going to, you know, kind of go after them or do a witch hunt like he's kind of suggested, if he really does that and ends up kind of purging or making it so uncomfortable for these people to be there, mm-hmm. that impact could be felt way beyond the next 4 years.
All right, Bob, thanks for that question. Yeah, we've seen an email going to scientists asking for names of people who've been attending these energy conferences. And there's been sort of this antagonistic relationship already between the Trump transition administration and a transition team and climate scientists. What are we to make of that, Meg Jacobs?
I mean, that, you know, that's a real source of concern, and this is what I was mentioning before. So you do have the ability, even if Perry can't get rid of the Department of Energy, you do have the ability to allocate resources or simply not allocate them and thereby have serious implications. And so the threat is that they will stop the funding for any kind of climate change research. And so you have stories not only of them trying to sort of collect names and all that, but of scientists themselves who are worried that the existing sort of data that government agencies have collected will sort of simply vanish. So I think the Washington Post had a story of scientists sort of madly trying to download as much data for fear that it will simply disappear.
Mm. Katie Fehrenbacher, when we talked about this a little bit earlier, but you know, about how new energy, new forms of clean energy are getting much cheaper to produce, whether it's solar or wind. These industries are at this point are kind of self-sustaining as compared to, say, the coal industry, and seem like there's not much that can be done to prevent them from continuing to thrive at this point. But what about other types of energy that are still in the experimental stage? What is going to happen with, you know, if we don't have the funding for the Department of Energy and we have that sort of a brain drain, are we going to be missing out on new opportunities for finding new, cheap, renewable sources of energy?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. So Stephen Chu and Ernie Moniz, the past two Secretary of Energies, really created this kind of energy innovation and technology center at the Department of Energy. And the Department of Energy invests a lot into energy research. And so, you know, out of it's a program called ARPA-E at the Department of Energy. So out of that program, you know, there's been a lot of energy innovations that have come out. So there's the fear that, you know, if the administration, the Trump administration, puts a dampering on programs like that, there could be really a problem with what kind of is the next generation of energy technology that comes out. I mean, on the flip side, I mean, like you said, clean energy, solar and wind are maturing industries and are at the cheapest time in history. And it's hopefully the Trump administration won't be able to remove or accelerate the tax credits that those industries have been getting for a while. Those are supposed to ramp down in the next couple years, but hopefully the administration won't do anything about those. But like you said, you know, these kind of next generation energy technologies really need kind of a healthy R&D budget from the government, and that is definitely in jeopardy. But if you look towards investors in the private sector, there is some level of support for trying to find these new energy technologies. Just a couple weeks ago, Bill Gates announced a new $1 billion fund to try to find breakthrough energy technologies. So there are some new sources of funding for new energy, clean energy technologies.
Mm-hmm. I should mention that just 2 days ago, President Barack Obama barred offshore drilling in areas of the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans indefinitely. Meg Jacobs, how powerful is that a move in terms of preventing some of the things that President-elect Donald Trump has promised to do?
Well, I mean, the question is, you know, you have Obama who's trying to do as much as he can before he leaves office, and the hope is that he takes actions that Trump won't be able to reverse. And there's precedents for this, too. So, for example, Jimmy Carter, who was, you know, pro-conservation in many respects, right before he left office, he also similarly tried to designate large areas of the Arctic off grounds, off limits for the oil industry, and a lot of that stuck. And so, for example, we have not been seeing the drilling in Alaska that many in the industry would hope for. So it can have sort of profound implications. The question is, what will a Trump administration attempt to do to reverse and combat and fight any of these laws? And will they have power? Will they have the corresponding power they need on Capitol Hill? And unlike in the Reagan years, you now have a situation with united government with Republicans controlling Congress, and that potentially gives Trump much more power to reverse a lot of the regulatory authority that undergirds these moves.
Katie Fehrenbacher, how likely is it that Congress would follow Trump on these sorts of policies to undo moves made by President Barack Obama about, you know, in terms of drilling in offshore Arctic and Atlantic oceans?
It's unclear right now. I mean, I think it's likely. I think that it's concerning, and there's a high probability that they would.
There's a high probability that you would, you say?
That they would follow the Trump administration, I would think.
Trump has also said that he'd like to kill Obama's clean power plan.
Right. So, you know, the clean power plan is something that has been controversial from the start, but it requires power companies to lower their carbon emissions, their greenhouse gas emissions by a certain amount by a certain year. So, you know, if that is able to be dismantled, then, you know, a significant amount of the carbon emissions that the U.S. has pledged to reduce will not happen. But that's, you know, I think that's potentially likely.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Kelly on the line in Houston. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I just found the Oklahoma appointment very interesting, given that the governor of Oklahoma found it necessary to cut production on fracking wells in order to try to decrease the number of earthquakes. That was a really pro-oil administration, but yet they took this drastic step of telling the oil drillers to cut production to try to stop earthquakes. Hmm. I just thought that would be an interesting thing to talk about a little.
Thanks, Kelly. So, Katie Fehrenbacher, is this true that Oklahoma's had to cut production because of earthquakes?
Well, so, I mean, what happened is that when they get rid of the water that they use for fracking, mm-hmm. that they're putting it into some of these cracks. So, and they had found that this has been causing earthquakes in certain regions.
Mm-hmm.
I know it had happened in California. I think it had happened in Oklahoma. I haven't followed it too closely.
Mm-hmm.
But there's ways to potentially not cut their industry too drastically. They can take other measures, like get rid of wastewater in other ways.
Mm. Other ways that might affect the environment.
Correct. Yeah.
Meg Jacobs?
Well, you know, I mean, to your caller's point, the question is, how do you read these kinds of moves? Or, you know, one reading on the surface of them could reflect a sort of concern for the environment. Another reading could be an effort to take a sort of preemptive action to avoid tougher federal regulations from coming in and attempting to ban these kinds of practices. So, you know, and that has a history, too, of sort of states or even industries favoring certain regulations that they think would then forestall more aggressive regulations that they would not be happy with.
Hmm. We're talking this hour about President-elect Donald Trump's his policies, his promises that he's made around energy and climate change, and the appointees people he's nominated to certain positions in his cabinet, and how that what sort of signals we're getting from that in terms of how he might lead in terms of energy and climate change. If you'd like to join with your question or comment, your hope or concern, give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. 800-228-2828. We'll get back to your calls in just a moment, but first it's time for an update of news headlines with Phil Picardi. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Marianne. A State Department official says two U.S. citizens are among the 48 people injured in the attack on a Christmas market in Berlin that left 12 others dead. The Berlin market reopened today with extra security. Authorities across Europe are scrambling to track down a Tunisian man suspected of driving the truck into the Christmas market. German authorities are offering a $100,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of Anas Amri. One of his brothers is urging Amri to turn himself in. Three car bombs have ripped through an outdoor market in the Iraqi city of Mosul, killing at least 15 civilians and 8 policemen. The defense ministry says today's attack happened in an eastern district that Iraqi forces retook from Islamic State militants weeks ago. Donald Trump's campaign manager Kellyanne Conway will be working at the White House in January as a counselor to the president. The Trump transition team says she will work with senior leadership in the White House to effectively message and execute the administration's legislative priorities and actions. Conway served as Trump's third campaign manager and is widely credited with helping him to victory. A battle over financial disclosures could be brewing for the opening days of the Trump administration. The top Democrats on Senate committees that will consider Donald Trump's cabinet nominees say those picks should not get a Senate vote without completing a disclosure statement and providing information about financial holdings. And it's a strong showing for the U.S. economy. The government says the economy grew at a 3.5% annual rate in the third quarter of the year. That is the fastest pace in 2 years. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:37.
Stay tuned. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Paul Huttner is going to go over some of the biggest climate events of the past year. That's coming up at 10. And then around 10:30 or so, we're going to start talking about finding those perfect gifts. I know some of you have been procrastinating. We're going to try and keep it simple and effective for last-minute gift shopping. That's coming up.
Programming is supported by Health Partners and MakeItOkay.org, a campaign to start conversations about mental illness and stop the stigma. You can learn more about the misconceptions around mental illness at MakeItOkay.org.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. We're talking this hour about climate change and energy policy under President-elect Donald Trump. I'm joined by Katie Fehrenbacher, energy and technology journalist, and Meg Jacobs, research scholar at Princeton University and author of Panic at the Pump. Let's go straight to the phones. We've got Dave on the line in Rochester. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I wanted to interject a little optimism.
Sure.
A lot of this is consumer demand driven, and there's strong demand out there, in my opinion, for like Energy Star appliances and products and fuel efficient cars. And as long as that demand's there, I think there'll be a drive to develop these types of products that will inevitably reduce our emissions. And really, in my mind, I'm personally not a big government type of guy. I think that getting more private dollars interested in developing these products, which could potentially be booms for the U.S. economy, hopefully for us, you know, I think could be a good thing. It makes us less dependent on these whims, these political whims, and what administration happens to be in power.
So a caller earlier who was worried about a brain drain from the Department of Energy, those could be going into the private industry and could be fueling who knows what kind of new inventions and industries. Hopefully. Okay. Dave, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate it. Meg Jacobs, what do you think? Reason for optimism?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think there is a sort of revolving door between government and industry, but I think it's not so much. I think it's certainly the case that what we have seen in the last generation is the universities in particular sort of playing a lead role in collaboration at times with industry, at times with government, to generate the next set of technologies that we need for a fossil-free future. And so that's sort of ongoing, and I think has been ongoing throughout the Obama years. Ernie Moniz came from MIT, where I taught for 15 years. You know, there was a huge project at MIT that has been ongoing. They partner with the leading oil companies, and that will remain and continue to be ongoing.
Katie Fehrenbacher, you know, as you mentioned earlier, under Rick Perry, Texas has heavily promoted wind. It now makes up more than 10% of the energy the state consumes. So we should be taking some cues from this, that there is going to be more investment in wind and solar, perhaps?
I think hopefully the Trump administration will just let the solar and wind markets continue as they have been. I'm not sure they will get future support. I don't think there'll be big legislation providing new incentives for wind and solar, but I think hopefully they'll let wind and solar alone in the U.S. But just to kind of follow on with the caller was previously saying, I mean, I'm optimistic in terms of kind of the early and emerging shift to electric cars. I know there's not that many out there yet, but I'm based in San Francisco, and you know, Tesla Motors is a successful company out here. They just acquired their sister company, Solar City. So Elon Musk is going to be selling electric cars along with solar panels and batteries. You know, there is this kind of small but emerging energy technology private sector that hopefully will grow over time.
You mentioned being based in San Francisco, and that reminded me about states' roles in all of this. I mean, states have a serious role to play in setting their own policy and their own regulations for certain aspects of energy and climate. Isn't that right, Katie?
They do. They have a very strong history of providing state incentives. So states like California have the renewable portfolio standards, which say the utilities in the state need to have a certain amount of renewable energy by a certain year. So that pushes the utilities to buy energy from large wind and solar farms. And that has been a massive driver of clean energy in America. I listened to a speech a couple weeks ago by California Governor Jerry Brown, and it was very inspiring in that Governor Brown was saying, you know, California is going to do everything in its power to keep on the path of promoting clean energy and lowering carbon emissions. And the state would do whatever it could to kind of help out in the fight against an administration that was trying to get in the way of that. So if, you know, some of the climate scientists were concerned about where their data was going, you know, you could send it to California data centers or something like that. So I could see how different states could take a stand against federal policy that was going in the opposite direction of how states wanted.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Alex on the line in New Richmond, Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Yeah, thank you. I have not heard any journalists speculating about this point yet, but I'm terribly concerned that Rex Tillerson has been, you know, selected as Secretary of State, because I see that move as being indicative that Trump is going to use an experienced, educated man of the gas and oil industries to help roll back climate initiatives for the U.S. and possibly for the world. I see Tillerson as not having really ever stuck by his statements about believing in climate change. He still seems to represent fossil fuel interests to me, and I think that's how Trump is going to use him.
Alex, thanks for that call. Meg Jacobs, what do you think of that?
I think that's a fair concern. You know, we've been talking a lot about the role of science and research, and there were a couple of interesting articles about ExxonMobil's efforts to first investigate the science behind climate change and then disavow it. These articles were in the New York Review of Books, and it's very clear that under Tillerson, that effort has been very consistent. to try and delegitimize the scientific research that the company itself undertook starting in the 1970s. So I think that there's good reasons to be concerned that that would be the path that he would continue on as from his position as Secretary of State.
Talking about the Paris Agreement from last year that the nations joined together on, and that that President-elect Donald Trump has said he'd like to cancel or rip up, here's a voice you wouldn't expect to advocate in favor of the Paris Agreement.
President-elect Trump should accept the Paris Treaty on Climate to buy some goodwill overseas. It doesn't really amount to much anyway. Let it go.
Bill O'Reilly, advocating for the Paris Agreement. Is that a shocker to hear these conservative pundits saying, hey, now, let's leave some of this global, you know, the climate change policies in place? Meg Jacobs?
I don't think so. I mean, because, you know, you could, even in the clip you just said, you know, that it's not he's not taking it that seriously as something that's a mandate to do anything. So you can sort of have these goals you aspire to, but it's a question of what public policies you're willing to support to implement them. And as we've discussed already, you know, there will clearly be an effort to check Obama's Clean Power Plan, which is already caught up in the courts, but to make sure that that doesn't proceed.
Mm-hmm. Katie Fehrenbacher, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I'm surprised to hear Bill O'Reilly say those words, but I agree with Meg. I think the sentiment is just kind of casual, blasé.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Carol on the line in Morris. Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for your information that you give to us each day.
Oh, happy to do it.
One thing that I am interested in is, as a citizen, what are the ways that I can best make my voice heard so that we can keep some of these policies we already have in place?
Great question, Carol. So, Katie Fehrenbacher, what can the ordinary citizen do if they're concerned about climate science and some of these new policies?
I think one way, not necessarily with voice, but with pocketbook. I mean, I think that if there's any ways you can, like the previous caller called in, you know, buy energy efficient products or spend money on more environmentally friendly goods. I think that's one way that that someone can have a larger effect on some of these issues. There's also just, you know, speaking out, having a voice, connecting with local groups, environmental groups, climate change groups. So just speaking out and educating other people.
Meg Jacobs?
Yeah, I mean, and it's really a question of mobilizing politically. That's really quite significant. So, you know, all through the 80s, even as you had a Reagan White House that was hostile to environmental and energy regulation, you had growing sentiment and concern, for example, over acid rain and the threat posed by acid rain. And ultimately, George H.W. Bush, when he came into office, felt political pressure to do something and to sign the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. And so really, that's what it's going to take more than anything else, which is sort of mobilizing politically and putting pressure on congressmen, joining grassroots organizations that lobby within Washington to make that point of view known at the ballot box.
Mm. Dee in Apple Valley writes, I'm concerned that it might be too late on climate change. I think we've already lost so much. It's hard to mitigate things like polar ice caps, etc. Does Dee have a point? Are we sort of late to the party on this anyway in terms of making substantial changes to climate change, global warming? Katie Fehrenbacher?
I mean, I think they have a point, but I think that you know, some level of climate changing is already occurring now. So a lot of, you know, some of these vulnerable communities are having to adapt. So it's already happening now. But I think that the fact that the energy infrastructure and transportation infrastructure needs to transform. So to remove greenhouse gas emissions, I think that needs to happen for it not to get so much worse. I mean, it's a matter of, do you want these millions of people to die, or these tens and hundreds of millions of people to die? You know, I think it's already happening. It's going to happen. But how bad is it going to get?
We're talking this hour about President-elect Donald Trump's policies on energy and climate change, his appointees, and what we can signal from that at this point in the game with just 4 weeks left before he is inaugurated as president. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. We're talking this hour with Katie Fehrenbacher, energy and technology journalist, and Meg Jacobs, research scholar at Princeton University. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Brian on the line in Chaska. Brian, welcome.
Thanks a lot. Listen, I'm a geologist. I went to St. Thomas. Actually, 99%, I would say, of geologists know that there's been dramatic climate change, and the ice cores prove that for 800,000 years, there's been systematic and huge changes in the temperatures. We've had 2 miles of ice in the past over Minnesota, and there's been times in the past where there's been no ice at all. This is before man was invented. So I wonder about where all the geologists are in this discussion. But the point I wanted to make this morning is fracking and natural gas has lowered our carbon footprint more than any other technology, because we're converting our coal plants to natural gas, which is at least 100 times cleaner than coal. This China has shale. India has shale. This technology could stop the creation of coal plants. And they're, as you know, they're going to be building, based on the Paris Accord, they don't have to do anything until 2030. And maybe this is why they're thinking about ripping up this agreement. It's just not fair. But this technology could immediately stop these coal plants because it's cheaper, not because they're worried about global warming or anything else. It's cheaper. So, but there's this assault. People like Michael Mann, who real scientists have demolished his hockey stick curve. It's a lie, essentially, and he's been caught red-handed. But they're so programmed to hate fossil fuel, which creates all of our plastics that everyone uses, all of the chemicals that we need. They come out of an oil well. So as a geologist, I'm super concerned about hysteria. We just heard someone say hundreds of millions of people dying. These are the kinds of words. And denier hooks me up with the people who didn't believe the Holocaust exists. These words are offensive. So what about natural gas? What about fracking to stop the production of hundreds of coal plants in China and India?
All right, Brian, thanks for your call. Katie Fehrenbacher, do you want to handle that one?
Sure. I mean, I agree with the caller in the fact that natural gas has become so cheap through shale and fracking that it has made the coal industry largely becoming uneconomic in the U.S. Natural gas is responsible for the decline of the coal industry more than renewables are, for sure. I think that that natural gas does admit greenhouse gases is concerning on that level, but I think that he's correct in that the U.S. has lowered its carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, through replacing coal with natural gas over the last several years. So that's absolutely true.
And what do you think about focusing on other countries and getting them off of coal and onto natural gas, as opposed to working on things, working on United States, getting on cleaner energy systems?
I mean, China does what China wants. I mean, if I'm not sure what exactly the question is. Is that should we convince other countries to buy shale gas? I'm not sure. I mean, countries, China will buy. China is buying whatever it can for its increasing power demands. So it's buying cheap power. It's buying renewables. It's buying whatever it can. So I'm not sure we can dictate what other countries buy.
And what about his comment that, you know, we're being hyperbolic here and talking when you're talking about millions of people dying now versus later?
I don't think it's necessarily extreme to say that millions of people would die. I mean, I'm not saying now, but you know, over time. I mean, that's just part of the changing climate. So, you know, lots of money would be lost. Lots of people would be displaced. Lots of places would be uninhabitable. So, you know, it's not just that. I mean, and that was one point. Maybe mm-hmm. I should have been more nuanced in my point.
Mm-hmm.
Go
ahead, Meg.
I mean, I think that I think the caller has a point in as much as there's a basic thing, and we haven't talked a lot about it in the last hour, which is energy prices are relatively cheap right now. And, you know, history suggests that when energy is cheap, people use more of it. And so to point out that so much of our lifestyle is dependent on fossil fuel production is a really central, important reality, both in terms of our economy and in terms of our consumer lifestyles. And that's a reality that all of us need to face and accept. And so even while we can identify new technologies or hope that the electric car will radically transform our emissions, the reality is we live a very fossil fuel dependent lifestyle. And so that's a real challenge of how to move beyond it, especially with energy prices so low, which not only encourages consumption, but discourages the adoption of other new kinds of technologies.
We have time for just one last call. Let's go to Edward in Rochester. Edward, welcome to the program.
Thank you. A couple of quick points. One, the reality of climate change is unquestionable, and the impacts of climate change are irreversible. It will be the young people of not only this country, but of this entire planet who will be the loser. And my question would be, will the U.S. be treated as a pariah by the nations of the world if this radical direction is taken?
Mm. Edward, thanks for that that call and that question. Katie Fehrenbacher?
I think it's a possibility that I'm not sure pariah, but I think it's a possibility that you know, the other nations that will lead on this, Europe, potentially China, will definitely you know, be upset and be vocal about it. And I think it will put the U.S. in a disadvantage if the U.S. continues to kind of be a barrier in these climate negotiations.
Meg Jacobs, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think the United States has an opportunity to be a leader. And I understand the concern in the transition from the Obama to the Trump years. So we'll just have to wait and see.
All right. We've been talking this hour about President-elect Donald Trump's thought, his direction on climate policy, energy policy, climate change, his appointments, and the promises he's made on the campaign trail. We've been talking with Katie Fehrenbacher, energy and technology journalist, and Meg Jacobs, research scholar at Princeton University and author of Panic at the Pump. Thanks so much to both of you for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
And stay tuned. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to be talking about some of the biggest climate events of the past year with Paul Huttner. That's in the first half of the hour. And then we're going to talk about gift giving, figure out some of those perfect gifts. It's the last days before Christmas. Some people are stressed out. They haven't found that perfect gift for their loved one. We're going to simplify that. We're going to take gift giving down to its basics. What are the best gifts to give to make sure that your loved ones are happy? That's coming up in the next hour here on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs. Thanks for listening.